It can take a lot to get ahead in this world, which is probably why we tend to frown on people who look like they're trying to cut the line and get ahead the quick way, especially if that quick way involves impressing the boss with compliments and flattery. This is the material of a small book written by a pair of Virginia professors. It is called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Deborah Parker is a professor of Italian at the University of Virginia. Mark Parker, a professor of English at James Madison University. They wrote a previous book together, Inferno Revealed, From Dante to Dan Brown. Mark Parker is our guest on The Exchange. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
So this is a departure from Dante, certainly. How did you get onto this subject?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. It was something that, being in our jobs, we saw things like this all around us, and a lot of our friends would speak about this or talk about this, and we kind of saw that people turn all of these stories into anecdotes, and they're quite funny and very amusing, but we really wanted to know a little bit more about it. It just seemed like such an interesting bit of human behavior that something like this would be done so often and so well.
You do not work in the corporate world or in politics. Am I unfairly assuming that the highest forms of sucking up take place in those fields?
That would be hard for me to say, but it certainly seems one of the unexpected pleasures of our book is that when we began writing it, we weren't really thinking much about politics except for historical examples, but the recent political landscape has seemed just like a kind of a sycophancy fest.
Well, in fact, you mentioned Dick Cheney's shooting victim when Dick Cheney was vice president. So it's not just about climbing the ladder and impressing the boss, trying to figure out the motivations for his victim.
Yeah, that was a wonderful story back in 2006 when Dick Cheney basically was out on a shooting expedition and aimed downward. He aimed at dusk, and he aimed at an uncertain target, and he shot the man that he was out shooting with in the face, the neck, and the upper torso. And after a week in the hospital, in which the victim, Harry Whittington, had really quite a few sort of medical problems, he had a collapsed lung and a few other things like that, he came out and he said, "My family and I are deeply sorry for all that Vice President Cheney and his family have had to go through this week." And that was an astonishing statement, given that he felt like his family needed to apologize as well.
Right.
To suck up.
That is. Okay, we'll get to other examples from the federal executive branch in a bit. But first, let's go back to the Bible, or at least John Milton's take on it.
Oh, gosh.
Sucking up in the Garden of Eden, eh?
Well, John Milton is writing about something he considers literally true, or something close to that. But he does take all of this care we found on looking back at the incident to sort of show the fall of mankind as being motivated in part by sucking up. He presents the devil as not only a snake, but also as a very duplicitous one and a very sinuous one, and has the snake licking the dust and doing exactly what bootlickers and sort of sycophants do throughout the presentation.
So I wonder if Milton actually set a bit of a form here. Did he like lay out a pattern or a mold for bootlickers to follow in the future?
I think that one of the things we found that was most interesting about thinking about this topic is that however much you try to define it, you're also pretty well laying out a kind of playbook for people who want to suck up. This occurs again and again in the research on sucking up, is that someone will anatomize it, and then part of what he says will become a kind of a sycophant's Bible.
There is a physical set of behaviors, at least suggested by obsequiousness. I tried to get on all the syllables at once there.
Yes, and one of the really wonderful things about this behavior is the kind of, I guess, traditional crowdsourced ingenuity that you get. You get these wonderful coinages: bootlicker, lick spittle, toad eater, brown noser, and of course the ones that go along with ass kissing, if I can say that, the whole range of that. These are wonderful words, and you can see that over time they've become so common because they sound good and they're spectacular. They really look like something that is comic and is a kind of way of criticizing the person who's doing it by making them seem comic and degraded.
You know, I started to think about the word lick spittle myself, which is one of my personal favorites, and decided I didn't want to think any more about what that might actually indicate. Ew. But we are talking, it is sycophancy, not sycophancy or anything like that. Right?
It's sycophancy, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's one of those false kinds of derivations. It's not from psycho like psychology, it's actually from the word for fig, sukkon.
So give us the roots of the word then. Go a little further back with us, Mark.
Well, I wish I could be more precise, but it's one of those roots that are very difficult to trace. It comes from two Greek words, one for the word to show and the other for the word for fig, the sort of like a date or something. So it's pheno and soukon. And no one really can tell. It's not one of those derivations where there's a kind of a story and it fits together nicely. It's really kind of hard to see what was being named by this, because showing the fig doesn't sound like sycophancy in a way. But there was a kind of a practice of allowing, there was a ban on the importation of figs at a certain point in Greece, and people who found people who were evading that were able to turn them in for a reward. So that kind of meddlesome intruder is certainly involved in that. And there's also the idea of maybe these people know where the figs, these desirable things, are. So there's a kind of a suggestion of cunning. And also there's a traditional showing the fig. This is a little less probably likely, which is a way of making a deprecating gesture to someone. So it kind of, in the mix, are duplicity, cunning, and aggression, which is kind of thought-provoking when you think about sycophancy.
Truly. Mark Parker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Deborah Parker are the authors of Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Maybe you've got some examples you'd like to deliver about people who've really done the job of a lickspittle, either around you or to you. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So I'm trying to understand the root of the word then. It sounds like at some time it was more like tattletale or revenue agent or something.
Yeah, or sort of a meddlesome informer is really the first sort of root of it. And there is a character in a play by Aristophanes called Sycophant, who basically is a kind of a professional investigator who turns people in for a reward. And he's very keen to sort of justify his behavior, although he's just as annoying as any sycophant would be anyway.
So Aristophanes and Milton aside, or at least the devil in Paradise Lost aside, is there one figure in literature that really did a lot to give the full image for the brown-nosed, scraping, bowing toady of today?
Wow. You know, one of the things we found was that there was, once we started looking for literary examples of sycophants and flatterers, they were just everywhere. But you'd have to put Dante quite at the top. His depiction of flattery in Inferno, in the first part of his Divine Comedy, is really quite thought-provoking. First of all, he puts flatterers down below murderers and tyrants. He puts them very deep in hell, in the eighth circle. And I have to say that every time I or my wife teaches Inferno, students are always confused, like, how could flattery be worse than murder? Because it sounds like just such a counterintuitive kind of thing. But his argument is rather interesting. He basically says it's a kind of fraud, and that has effects that go beyond just the interaction between the person and the victim, that it really tears at the fabric of society in ways that makes simple and direct and frank exchange impossible. So he has a kind of understanding of flattery that goes beyond just the sort of annoyance or the me-firstism that we often think about flattery in terms of.
So untruthfulness with a much broader consequence.
Yeah, it's a kind of fraud. He puts it right next to sowers of discord and thieves and all sorts of other people who are acting fraudulently.
Wow, the eighth circle of hell. Okay. I'm not going to be talking that nice to my boss today.
Yeah, and he also does he has that same excremental vision about flattery that other people do. He puts the flatterer...
Excremental vision, you said?
Yes, excremental vision. Yeah, he immerses his flatterers in waste, in feces. That's their punishment.
Wow, so because they spewed it in life, they get to live with it in
that
hell?
Is exactly it.
Wow.
So again, you know, those popular coinages of brown noser and things like that, they really have a kind of resonance between high and low culture.
Okay, so if the discussion of excrementalism didn't turn our listeners off, let's ask them to hold their gag reflexes further while you tell the story of Deng Tong and his service to Emperor.
He's a famous figure, and, you know, this is one of those figures that are kind of shrouded in the mist of time in a certain sense, because it's just so long ago, and it's almost as if he's a character on which many stories can be hung. But he was just a colossal flatterer who managed to do even more disgusting things than the brown nosing. I'm not sure we want to go into them on the radio. He was ready
to... Let's say he relieved his boss of some of his bodily humors when necessary.
He certainly did. Sucking a tumor, things like this. It's just, it really is sort of the limit case of this kind of thing. And he was very good at it. He managed to sort of use his ability to abase himself and go further than others to cut them out of the process of being rewarded.
It's amazing how similar these stories can sound, though, hundreds if not thousands of years apart, because then you move up in the book to Comrade Brezhnev, the boss of the Soviet Union. There's a great story in here about his flatterers one day at the beach.
Right. A dog comes up and licks his behind, and he says to him, "Oh, comrade, that's a little too much." That's a wonderful story. It's almost, I mean, one of the interesting things about this is that it is a troubling kind of thing, and Dante's, I think, right to hook it up to fraud and to see some devastating consequences, but it's also the opportunity for some real comic ingenuity. I mean, people just tell this story again and again in the most surprising and entertaining ways.
That is true. There's a great amount of pleasure we seem to get from telling these stories. It's like, oh, can you believe a person would put themselves that low?
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a kind of a contest, and one of the things that I think is clear in any office is, I guess we don't have water coolers anymore, but wherever people get together, they exchange these stories, and it's often a question of one-upmanship. I think we've all been in the position of we're annoyed, we tell a sycophancy story, and then someone immediately one-ups us, and it becomes not so much a real critique or a conversation about flattery, but a kind of a who can tell the best story.
Well, and actually, the lead-up to the Brezhnev piece before the dog licks him is all the actual members of the Communist Party are trying to outdo themselves with the flattery, and then Brezhnev turns over on his stomach on the beach, and that's when the dog licks his butt.
Right.
Really, comrade, that is too much. Mark Parker is our guest on The Exchange. His book with Deborah Parker is called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. It's a relatively small volume, but chock full of some great stories about sucking up through history. And we'll get into science as well in the future. You can join us here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So well, let's see. We had foreign capitals. Let's go to our own. I mean, how big is sucking up as a matter of practice in Washington, D.C.?
Well, when we started this book, Trump was really a kind of a, and the Trump regime was really not even thinkable. I mean, he was at that point just talking about Obama's birth certificate. He was really not it wasn't even clear that he was being considered as a serious candidate at the time. But when we looked at other sort of examples from politics, you could see just a rampant sycophancy on both sides. One of the things about being able to listen to the Watergate tapes or the tapes on the Vietnam War with Lyndon Johnson is it's a pretty equal opportunity kind of activity among the parties. Everybody seems to do it. And even Hillary Clinton's emails show a kind of, well, they've revealed a kind of well-worn path of sycophancy that is in evidence there as well. But the Trump, administration does one thing differently. There may not be more of it, but they really bring in a kind of the new media in using sycophancy. It really is a spectacle on display, and instead of being just an exchange between the sycophant and the target, it really brings in the class of observers and makes them, in many cases, complicit in the sycophancy, and that seems to be a different kind of thing.
You're talking about through Twitter, then, kissing up through Twitter?
Well, through Twitter and all sorts of social media. Even when Trump was in the sort of transition period after the election, there was that wonderful kind of moment where he was in Trump Tower at the top, waiting for applicants to come in to talk about possible jobs in the administration. And there was a kind of a dead-eye sort of surveillance cam down in the lobby, and you'd see these people go across, and it really was a kind of abasement procedure by sort of through the media. They'd walk through this place. It was a dead sort of space. There was the sound was very muddy. The camera would refocus and unfocus in these kinds of mechanical ways. It was really a way of, you know, diminishing these figures and taking them out of their usual ability to control their self-presentation. And then they go up, we whisk up to see Mr. Trump at that point. And that really became a focus for the media. looking at this camera, finding out who was up for jobs, and it became a sort of a wider spectacle, something for the observers and not just for the flattery of people coming to him to ask for jobs.
And then once they get the jobs, though, I really have to ask you about, and I know it's not in the book, but that cabinet meeting where each member of the cabinet in turn praised the president
publicly. Right, June 12th, that was really a kind
burned
of
into your mind, is it?
Eye-opening day, and it was really, I think, hard to believe that that would go on. You can probably see why it happened. It started and then it snowballed and everyone just sort of got in line, but it did really seem like most members of the cabinet were elbowing each other, trying to get further ingratiated with their boss by talking about what a blessing and how wonderful it was to work for him.
Well, yeah, I don't want to single out just the Trump administration. It might have heightened things a bit, but Henry Kissinger, for example, comes up for several pages in here. I mean, what do you regard as in several periods in his own personal history, what do you regard as the peak of his sycophancy?
Well, I think the most troubling one is one that has become quite well known. Golda Meir had come to speak to Nixon about some of the Jews who were being held against their will in Russia and mistreated. And Nixon really didn't want to do anything because he was interested in detente. He was interested in a kind of new relationship with Russia. And he was looking for reasons, I guess, from his staff. And Kissinger went further than anyone else. He said, it's really none of our business. Even if they were, even if they were killing Jews, it might be a moral issue, maybe, but it's really none of our business. And that was really, I think, the ultimate yes, boss kind of moment for Henry Kissinger, to sort of go against history and really, all real kind of moral considerations to basically back his boss and help him to not do what he did not want to do.
Well, Kissinger was a refugee from Nazi Germany himself, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And he knew full well what had happened. And to use that analogy, I mean, part of it, he was much criticized when this episode came out in the press. And some people said, well, he was just trying to show from a position of relative weakness that he was tougher than anyone else. But that kind of flattery just really it beggars the imagination. One really doesn't know what to say about it.
I should stop talking about Henry Kissinger as a was. He's an is. Henry Kissinger is still alive. He's 94 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Turned 94 back in May. I'm just looking up here. Mm-hmm. So before we get to the break, there's a section on the science of sycophancy. Are you going to tell me that this shows up on fMRIs or something?
Not yet, but I think inevitably almost anything will show up somewhere on an fMRI. There was a really pretty muscular amount of research done in the late 50s and 60s on sycophancy in psychology departments, and there's a wonderful book in 1964 by Edward Jones on ingratiation where he really kind of tried to, as best he could, first define it, which was difficult enough, and then sort of talk about how it works. He spent a lot of time sort of going through. This is the book that often has taken on a life of its own because there's 20 pages at the end of this book that has become known as a kind of a playbook or a Bible for sycophants where he kind of puts all of his findings into one place. And I think he was simply trying to do the scientific thing, but it also was a way of basically making it easy for everyone who wanted to suck up.
We'll talk more about the research of Edward Jones when we come back and talk more with Mark Parker about his book with Deborah Parker called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, maybe have some stories to swap or some relations from your own life about sycophancy. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the practice of, managing up is one version you've heard, pleasing the boss, being a lickspittle, a toady, a butt kisser. I mean, you name it. They're all in this book by Mark and Deborah Parker called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Deborah's a professor of Italian at the University of Virginia. Mark Parker, professor of English at James Madison University. We have Mark on the line with us from Virginia, and we're talking about the details of the book, and you can join us on The Exchange. You maybe have some stories to share from your own life about sucking up or people you've observed from a distance sucking up. We'd like to hear your stories at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So Edward Jones and his research in 1964, and I do want to point out this is not Edward D. Jones of stockbroker fame.
No, it's not Edward E.
And what field was he coming from?
He was a psychologist.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so his research was really just about what the mechanisms of sycophants
were?
Yes.
He had a lot of research concerns. He wanted to know which kinds of ingratiations were better. He wanted to know how it works with different levels of power when they're involved. And he also wanted to know how much the sycophant and the target recognize about their behavior. And he was very astute in sort of recognizing almost at once that sycophancy is a very complex human interaction, that what a sycophant thinks he or she is doing can be one thing, and what the target thinks is happening can be another thing, and what observers think about it can be yet another thing. So it really becomes a kind of complicated and ambiguous sort of activity very quickly.
Very different when viewed from different angles of the transaction,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and he even complicated that. This is what is really kind of wonderful about this book. He says that the sycophant is often unaware of his flattery, and that it's always difficult to tell when something is. There are certain acts of sycophancy that are almost indistinguishable from acts of kindness or just bare politeness. It all turns on intention. And intention is not always fully knowable, and so it becomes very difficult to sort of piece through this very quickly.
And not even fully knowable by the initiator, as you point out. The flatterers believe themselves to be sincere?
Yes. What he found was that the more it works, the more the flattery works, the more sincere the flatterer thinks he is being. It changes, in a certain sense, this is a deceptive behavior that seeks to change the perception of the target's world, to make him think that he's better than he is or the world is different than it is. And the feeling often is that it's a transaction that you can enter into and exit cleanly. But again and again, the research shows that the flatterer is often changed as much as the target.
I mean, I'm just one of the things that really strikes me is how asymmetrical the relationship is in the research of Edward Jones, that a person of equal or greater power can say the same things, but is viewed very differently.
Yes, power is an absolutely crucial kind of thing. And if you are flattering from an inferior position, it's incumbent, according to Jones, that you basically you consider carefully your boss, like how talented is he in sort of social situations? How astute is she at sort of figuring out what's actually going on? And there are certain kinds of flattery which work better given the different kind of boss you might have.
So a couple of comments from listeners here that I want to bring in, and not surprisingly, they're all political. Jamie in Medford said he used to refer to Tony Blair as Toady Blair for his relationship with G.W. Bush. I wonder if you examine that at all in the book.
Yes, we did. That was one of the ones that we had even before sort of the last stages when we were finishing this book and the administration, the current administration has started. He is an interesting figure because he had such credibility for so long about speaking out on the world stage, and he's just seemed to have kind of lost it all by staking it on a kind of flattering relationship that he had with George Bush. He was pummeled in his own press, called a poodle, and sort of depicted as a poodle and as a lapdog. And there's a famous memo where he was talking to, trying to shape how the Iraq situation would transpire, in which he basically capitulated completely to George Bush. And then after this act of just abject flattery, starting it in the memo, he then sort of came back and gave a really terrific sort of consideration of all of the difficulties of prosecuting this war. It's almost a kind of a sad story to see the reputation collapse that he endured.
And yet, I know that when President Obama, for example, was bowing to foreign visitors, the Fox Newses of the world made a lot of hay out of that, but it didn't seem to stick that much, at least with the general public.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be quite the issue, and he never really suffered from that. I think Obama way of sort of evading a lot of some of the criticism of Obama seemed to stick very deeply, but others did not.
All right, then another email here from Judy in Medford, who wonders if the political prank that Pence went along with his boss at the NFL game last weekend was a good example of sucking up. Says it's a good example of sucking up. Pence seems to be a puppet to Trump. Boy, there's a whole whole book there. I do remember Mike Pence in the early stages talking about this good man, and he stayed with it.
Yeah, that's this is where intention is crucial here, and it looks like he's kind of tipped his hand towards more flattery than a sort of an honest, indignant response to something that he saw. By all of the reports that are coming out about how he prepared for this moment, that it was something that was set up, and he intended to walk out as soon as something happened.
I should make it clear. He basically told the reporters to stay in the van. I think I'll be out pretty quickly.
That seems to tip your hand.
So back to the Edward Jones book about sycophancy from 1964. Is that a rare volume? Is there not much written about sycophancy up until your book?
I think that there's a steady stream of books that come out about it, and there's a lot of research currently in mostly coming out of business schools. Which really talk about how to employ ingratiation. It's not just on flattery, but it's how to use all of these arts to sort of make your way in the business world. And there's a great deal of research done there.
So a person can use the methods of trying to impress the boss, or flattery when deemed necessary, and still maintain some status.
Yeah, one of the most dispiriting things about this is that it seems to work. Everyone seems to agree, both in literature and in science. I mean, Austin's Sense and Sensibility is a wonderful novel that explores, in one sense, the kind of the progress of an inveterate sycophant, Lucy Steele, who uses every possible trick and abases herself in every possible way and comes out on top. And Austin's very sort of measured in the way she talks about Lucy Steele at the end. She's talks about it as an example of how what she calls unceasing attention to self-interest will work. And she says the only sacrifice, and this is why Austin is such a great writer, she says the only sacrifice is time and conscience. It's your work and your sort of sense of self that's the only thing that is sacrificed.
So that's another example of sycophancy in literature. Are there any really positive characterizations of sycophants in literature? Are they always the person you want to kick?
I think there's at best it's mixed, and you can see that in Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. That is a book about snobs, but the other side of being a snob is being a sycophant, and every snob in Proust begins by sucking up. And what Proust really adds here is he says that sycophants often have a kind of creativity. He calls it, in his words, the intervening effects of imagination, that to do this, you have to imagine the target as better than they are and as justifying this kind of activity. And so he sees them as something of a kind of artist or a life artist in their abilities to sort of transform these targets who may be rich or wealthy or aristocracy, but may not have anything really that needs to be emulated or admired in them. And you turn them into sort of something to revere. He has characters do that again and again. And Patricia Highsmith has a wonderfully snarky novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, in which she presents a character who is kind of a nobody, a nullity at the beginning, who's just doing kind of timid little criminal activities. But he really becomes a different person and a different kind of criminal and a very successful one once he starts being a sycophant. He basically has a target, and he realizes he has a kind of talent for this kind of sycophancy. And what he does, in the Proustian sense, is he overvalues the target. In a sense, he wants to become like the person he's sucking up to, but he makes that person into a person who might be worth admiring. By the end of the novel, he's a different person, Ripley. He is powerful. He is living a life that he has chosen. And one of the last images, when he's either going to be caught or get away with his crimes, is he imagines sailing to Greece like Jason or Ulysses returning. So he's achieved a kind of mythic status as a criminal by the end of the novel. So sycophancy can also develop hidden talents.
So he starts off toady and then in the process gains wealth and power and
prestige.
He does,
wealth, power, and ability.
And do people suck up to him then? Is he expected of other people as he's at the top?
That's not so clear. He does have proteges, for the most part, after this first novel in the series, there's five of them, I think. After the first novel, he becomes more sort of just a criminal who's doing various kinds of things, and he enjoys the game of being a criminal, but he's not so much a sycophant anymore.
So in transactions, above board ones, not the ones in the literature, I want to come back to the business world here. In relationships just starting, for example, I mean, does sucking up get people jobs?
Yes. Much of the literature in the coming out of the business school on flattery talks about what strategies of ingratiation to use in an interview. And they're very frank. They basically often will just kind of accept flattery and ingratiation as part of the currency of the realm in the what they call the market situation. And they basically give advice on how to sort of do this most effectively with customers or with bosses.
Now, the customers thing is a really interesting part of this because flattery and marketing, I mean, I think we all can remember going to a used car lot. And it's like, what's it going to take to get you into this car today?
Yeah, that really is. And they're very clear about the advantages. I mean, often they've been drug along the lines of behavioral economics as well. And some of the latest research suggests that even when customers know they're being flattered, even when they know it's gross, and even if they're unhappy with this at first, they might forget it over time and retain the feeling of being happy, even as they've forgotten the experience of being flattered and being disgusted, and then basically come back and shop and buy. So there's a kind of a complexity to this behavior that is really just seems to go on forever.
Mark, the term, and it can be pronounced a couple of ways, chivalry or chivalry shows up in here a few times. In what context?
Well, that was a way, one of the things we were interested in was how often the response to sycophancy becomes a kind of unruly unmasking. It's a kind of a game. And a charivari is an old medieval practice in which the people would basically patrol themselves. It's a sort of a lower and middle class practice in which people who offended prevailing norms would be sort of roughly treated and made fun of by a group. It was sort of like a kind of an informal police. And it was kind of like a little celebration that was done. And we thought that when you think of the coinages, the way in which we have renamed sycophancy and flattery in these spectacular ways like bootlicker or toad eater, there was a kind of a charivari effect as well there, in which people are being called out and humiliated kind of publicly.
So does your work on sycophancy conclude with any recommendations for how we use this information? Are there cautionary notes that you and Deborah are providing here?
I think that the literature tradition especially, I think, has covered it very well. And one of the things they start with, you know, back, way back in Plutarch, who's a Greek moralist, who has a wonderful essay on how to tell a flatterer from a friend, is that one of the things is that we have to eliminate what Plutarch calls the flatterer within, our desire for this kind of blandishment and this kind of flattery. And that's a good start, is to basically try to conceive of an office place in which people aren't enabling flattery and to try to call it out when people enable it. It's not just the flatterer. It's also the target who sort of elicits flattery. And that is one good place to start.
So it's a relationship that has senders and receivers as well.
Yes, very much.
And I just wonder how many more interviews you've done if everybody tells you just what a marvelous book this is.
I'll tell you one of the things, you know, you write a book, you love to hear praise, but this book sort of puts that into kind of an abeyance.
That's true. People are going to think, well,
But I think that in some ways, just if there were one thing we wanted to do is to make people begin to perhaps think a little bit about the language we use and try to find ways to be kind and true, or at least not unkind and not untrue. Talking to people, there's a lot of ways to say nice things to people without flattering.
Without going into the realm of untruthfulness, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a very, very tight little book, but compact. It's got lots of stuff in here. Deborah Parker and Mark Parker, the authors of Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Mark joined us today. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you for having me.
All right, pleasure.